Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello and welcome to episode 46 of the Chills at Will podcast. It is a pleasure today to be joined by Rowena Galovitz. She worked as a typesetter, proofreader in New York City in the 80s when she created art books for museums such as the Metropolitan Museum of Art and educational books for publishers such as Scholastic. And while she enjoyed the art and punk scene of the city, when she moved to Oaxaca, Mexico, she edited, translated, or oversaw the production of coffee table art books and art catalogs about Mexican art. In Mexico City, she worked as a subtitle editor doing closed captioning for films and TV series. In the literary world, her experience includes the translation of Latin American short stories and poetry. Some of her poetry translation won a World Literature Today Prize in 2018. In her current editing and translation work, she focuses broadly on the arts and humanities, and specifically on contemporary Mexican and early modern Spanish culture. Enthusiastic and knowledgeable about literary and religious texts in the early modern world, her scholarly pursuits about women writing in Spanish have entailed archival research in Mexico and Spain, which resulted in a master's thesis on Hipólita de Jesús, who lived from 1551 to 1624. She was a Barcelona nun who wrote over 20 books. Her archival research in Peru manifested in multiple presentations on a collage by Rosa de Lima, who lived from 1586 to 1617, about which she is currently writing a journal article that refers to Rosa de Lima, the collage. Her theoretical interests include gender and sexuality, intersectional feminism, and translation theory. She has taught classes at the university level in English as a second language, English composition, and intermediate Spanish. And she has developed syllabi on courses such as Women Who Wrote, Literature and Religion in the Pre-Modern World, The Long History of the End of the World, and Radical Women. She loves to teach students about how language and literature work, and she is particularly at ease when she teaches about a wide range of texts on a single theme from different historical periods. Parallel to her editorial and educational work, she created literature-inspired art in a variety of media for 3 decades, mostly in Mexico, where she held 5 one-woman exhibits, and she participated in over 60 group shows. Wow, that is quite a lot of diverse and cool and interesting and passionate and just unique experience. Welcome to the show. How did I do on the bio? Is there anything else you'd like to add?
You did fine. I had forgotten I had done all that stuff. And just to add to that, at the moment, I'm working on my PhD in religious studies and comparative literature, and I'm doing a certificate in literary translation at Indiana University, even though I am living in Santa Fe because of just some weird things. You know, I needed to come here for my health, and then the pandemic hit, and so I stayed, and here I am.
Right. Well, I love some of the titles just of the courses themselves. I can imagine that your students are very lucky to have you with such a wide range of knowledge and passion. And I love that in the bio it says she loves to teach students about how language and literature work, and teaching a wide range of texts on a single theme from different historical periods. I love that idea of, right, the one single theme, and you get at it from different ways.
Yeah, it really yields so many interesting things. And once I get started on something like that, I just keep seeing more and more examples of, oh, I could do this and I could do that. And then my problem just becomes that I have too many things for one single course.
Right? Yes, That's a good problem to have, right?
Yeah, right. Problem in quotes.
So I know that you're in Santa Fe right now. Kind of talking about where you grew up. Was it a print-rich environment? Were you bilingual growing up or monolingual? How did that go? What was your relationship with language, especially as a kid?
Well, I was born in New Jersey, and I grew up in Pennsylvania in the Pocono Mountains.
Okay.
There wasn't really a literary scene in that small town of Pennsylvania, but my maternal grandparents were really big readers, and I remember that my maternal grandmother would go to the religiously to the library every single week. And when I visited her as a child, I would go with her. That was just sort of the thing that you did with grandma, right? Or with Grammy. So I think that had a big influence on me. I was interested in ballet and photography when I was a child. My father was a pianist. So there was literature and art in my life even then. I liked to read science fiction at that time. Then I moved to New York to study studio art. I moved to New York City, so this was in the 80s and the early 80s. So the punk scene was really happening, really exciting stuff there. Lots of just art and music and performance and theater sort of all melding together. And that's when I think as soon as I got to college, my interest in literature really grew. Mm-hmm. I started taking literature classes, even though I was doing studio art. And I studied French in college, wow. But there was no bilingual, there was no real second language at all in my childhood. And then a little later on, I just started taking up Spanish and taking courses, at the community college. And I just kept taking the courses, mm-hmm. Whenever I saw something, I just kept taking them. And then I went to Mexico and did some more language work. And then I eventually lived there. And, that was really, I feel like all those courses were just preparation for that. Mm-hmm. It's when you live in a place that you really learn a language.
Yeah. Going back to a little bit to the punk rock scene, I feel like I have a passing knowledge of punk rock and punk rock's history. I mean, who were the bands then? Who were the ones that you were following that were really big?
Oh, there were
so many.
all of them. I don't know. I really loved Patti Smith, and I think that she to this day is an important figure for me because of her, just utter dedication to music and to poetry.
Right.
And really, her music was poetry, and just her attitude about life, which was just, 100% giving her all, really outspoken about political matters.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, really very sensitive to the world and literature. But I was, also interested in the heavier bands like the Buzzcocks and Slits and the Clash, Iggy Pop. Yeah, I went to as many concerts as I possibly could.
Did you receive many injuries from those days?
No, not really.
Okay, oh, that's good. All right. So you went from New York City, one of the world's, biggest cities by population, one of the world's biggest cities by media and arts, to Mexico City, just depending on the year, top two or three as far as population goes in the world. And just, again, full of so much culture. Tell us a little bit about Mexico City. What were you doing there? What did you study there? What did you see there?
Actually, we need to back up a little bit because I first went to Oaxaca, and that's okay. Where I lived for, I lived there for 17 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I went because I wanted to spend 6 months painting without having to think about money. I had saved up some money, and then I went and I just fell in love with it. And so I stayed, and I also fell in love with a Oaxaqueño. So, that was another compelling reason to stay. But, it's just an incredible place, a really, special place in terms of landscape and architecture and culture. And at the time, there was a real boom in the art world as well. So I started out teaching ESL, and then I was still, you know, I was always making art all mm-hmm. the time there. And then I branched out into doing translation, but all the time I was making art, that was always related to research.
Okay.
And also I was, you know, hanging out with a lot of artists and writers and poets, and they all taught me a lot, especially the writers and poets. They helped me with my Spanish quite a bit. Mm. And so there were sometimes there were collaborations with some of these writers and poets, or I was translating some of their work. So that was a really important influence on me. And then at a certain point, I just felt the need to be in a big city again. So that's when I moved with my son to Mexico City. I spent 4 years there. I had already had quite a few friends who lived there, so the transition wasn't difficult for me at all. And I also, it's a really great, fascinating city, like no other, completely modern in many ways, but also just, you know, that the presence there, there's the pre-Hispanic presence there, there's the colonial presence there, and to live in that combination right. of spheres is just awesome.
Yeah, I've never been, I've always wanted to go. I've always been so entranced by just, like you talked about, the big everything, you know, big history, a lot of people, a lot of pollution, great food, great culture, you know, all the above. Going back a little bit, I guess, but in your Oaxaca time, in your time in Mexico City, and even before, who were the writers, English or Spanish, who wrote in English or Spanish, who really gave you chills at will? The ones who really have inspired you, who made you want to read their work?
Yeah, I was thinking about this a little bit before. So I think there were periods, there was that early period with science fiction, and mm-hmm. then there was this sort of modern European period where I was interested in authors like Henry Miller and Anais Nin and Virginia Woolf. And, you know, more recently, I think I really kind of branched out in my reading. Richard Wright is somebody that I read a couple of years ago and really loved. He's just, Native Son, it's an exceptional book. Frankenstein is another one. So that sort of harks back to my interest in science fiction. And sure. I recently read some H.G. Wells again. Science, you know, he was the master of science fiction. I've read some W.E.B. Du Bois lately. Uh-huh. I read the Daniel Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year and realized it completely relates to the pandemic. It's astounding. You know, my mouth was dropping like, this can't be. Alexis Pauline Gumbs, M. Archive, and Olivia Butler's Parable of the Sower. So yeah, I've sort of been going, I guess I've been going back to this sort of science fictions because of climate change. You know, I've been going back to that. I read it in English. She sometimes writes in Spanish, Valeria Luiselli, Tell Me How It Ends. Right now I'm reading Manuel Astor's San, El Libro de los Milagros, which is an extraordinary book. It's just, it's beautiful. And I'm also, so I've been learning Catalan. So I'm reading Mercè Rodoreda's Miral Trencat right now. And there are many, many others, you know, in terms of Mexican writers that and friends and Oaxacan writers, there are many, many others to mention.
The book you talked about, The Year of the Plague, is that the correct title?
A Journal of the Plague Year.
The Plague mm-hmm. Year. What year or approximately or exactly was that written?
That's the late 17th century.
Oh my gosh.
He's actually writing about a previous event in London, you know, the second plague in London.
Okay.
But reading it through the lens of the current pandemic, you realize that a lot of the things that we're seeing that the way that people have reacted to the pandemic, the various responses, are, it's really just human nature. Because if Defoe was writing about that in a different time, in a different place, and people were acting similarly, you understand it's human nature.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
About, you know, 300 years ago or so, and still pertinent today. As far as you being a writer, a translator, editor, what does that look like on a daily basis? You know, especially in pandemic times, are you like, okay, I'm going to knock out 3 hours, or are you more like, hey, I'm going to get it done when I can get it done? How does that work for you?
I think it depends. My, one of my professors, he said at some point during one of the classes, he mentioned that he gets up at 4:30 in the morning and writes for, I don't know, 2 hours or so, or translates for 2 hours. And I kind of took that as an inspiration. I don't know. It really depends. When I've got a specific project, sometimes it's the entire day, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm also getting up really early and working for maybe an hour in the, every day. Mm-hmm. I would like to have more time, but I also have teaching and taking classes and all of this. Yeah, it depends.
Okay.
Depends on the project. It depends on my other responsibilities at the moment.
Well, yeah, I'd love to hone in a little bit on translating. Remember when I was a kid, I was, I don't know, 8 or 9, maybe a little bit older. And I got an Italian to English dictionary, English Italian dictionary. And at the time, for some reason, I was really into Jesus Christ Superstar.
I remember that. Yeah.
Right. I don't know why. It was kind of short lived. But I remember I looked up Jesus Christ Superstar in Italian, and I found some Gesù Cristo Superficial Divo, which is like, you know, star as in like star in the sky, is like totally literal. It like would not work. But I always remember that's what I learned. Right. So I have that idea. And there's also the idea that I would look at things, they would say like translated from the Greek, from the Arabic, from, and I always thought that was so cool, so formal, so official, you know, the, but then part of me was like, well, all you need is like a dictionary. And obviously I was very naive. What goes into translating? It's obviously, I mean, there are prizes. You talked about winning prizes. It is clearly an art. You know, can you kind of put that into context for us? What does that mean to translate? What goes into that?
Well, I think everything goes into it. You know, I'm working on a sample right now, and I've been taking notes as I go about the decisions that I make. And I realized when I, you know, and I guess I've never really taken notes before, but I realized that I am constantly with every sentence or every word, I'm making decisions. So, I mean, you're trying to, on the one hand, you're trying to really understand the original, right? You're trying to read it and sit with it and let it sink in, right? And sometimes that understanding means you need to come back to it and read it several times. And sometimes it means research, you know, research about that particular thing or place or time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it means using the dictionary, but sometimes dictionaries don't work for what I'm trying to understand. I'm very grateful for all of my Spanish speaking friends, because when all else fails, then I post something on Facebook and ask them about a phrase.
Yes.
So that's definitely one thing I do. And I also occasionally will, if the writer is alive, I will write to the writer. And sometimes it turns out that the writer says, oh yeah, I see that wasn't very clear. You know, it depends if whether it's a published book or not, but I'm often sometimes dealing with, you know, unpublished manuscripts. And so that's sort of the first part. And then the other part is rendering it into something that makes sense in English, right? Sure. So definitely a dictionary is only a small part of that. Mm-hmm. A thesaurus is another, a thesaurus in English is another part of it. It usually goes through, my process goes through at least 3 drafts. And I often let the draft sit for a while. Mm-hmm. I need to let the draft sit for a while. Because otherwise, if it's too close, I just can't see it anymore. So, and then there's also a stage where I've got the draft and I'm comparing it with the original to make sure I have really understood, I haven't missed anything. So it's a very complex and rich and wonderful process.
Right.
You know?
I like how you spin it to the positive. Yes, it sounds like it's incredibly rich and enriching. I thought it was interesting what you talk about the writing to the writer. I wonder about the sense of responsibility you might feel, you know, like, hey, I'm translating so-and-so's work. Like, there's, I guess on the positive side, it's responsibility. On the negative side is pressure, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely responsibility because I want to get it right. I want to respect that work. You know, mm-hmm. I want to make sure that I understood the work. And of course, all great literature has the possibility of interpreting it in different ways, sure. Right? But, and so sometimes one of my responsibilities is leaving that open-ended question, right? Leaving mm-hmm. it. In fact, sometimes the original has three meanings, right? There's one word that has three definitions and English only has two definitions or one definition. So how do I confront a situation like that? Mm-hmm. But whenever it's possible, I try to leave that polyvalent significance in the English as well.
Sure. I really appreciate you talking about the thesaurus, as hard as that word is to say, thesaurus. You know, I tell my students, you know, get to know the dictionary, but definitely get to know the thesaurus.
You know,
find yourself using the same word 3 and 4 times, especially as I ask them to read it out loud, you know, their papers and stuff. That's great. Yeah, the thesaurus, I got to imagine for a translator would be crucial as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, you're thinking in two languages, and sometimes it's like, I find that I completely understand the Spanish and what it's trying to say, but I'm not articulating it the way I want. It's like, it's in here, but when it's on the paper or in the computer, I'm not quite getting it. So that thesaurus helps me to get to that next step. Mm-hmm. And definitely, you know, one of the things that I do is that I read all of my translations, no matter how long, read it out loud.
Yes.
As a process of hearing myself as sort of a test of whether I've gotten it right or not. Yeah. On the one hand, I'm really trying to get to understand the text, right? The original text. But on the other hand, I'm trying to make it as readable as I possibly can in English, right?
That makes a lot of sense. And I appreciate again that someone with your history and your knowledge that you're saying, read your work out loud. I'm going to get that little snippet and play it for my students at the important time. Definitely. I got to imagine that you're a lot of a historian too, right? If you're translating older Spanish or whatever language, right? You got to know some of the history, you got to know some of the context, and you need to understand maybe, I guess that kind of delves too into my next question, which is how do you balance, let's say, modern norms? You know, what if you're translating something that today would be seen as, you know, grossly racist or sexist or homophobic? You know, how does that kind of come into play? I guess historical context, yeah.
I think I hear a two-part question here. So on the first question, I would say that yes, the historical, it's really important to understand the historical context, right? Whether it be something from 5 centuries ago, like I'm working on something from Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz right now, but you need to understand that particular time period and even her particular convent culture. And also the meanings of certain words were not the same back then. So I use old dictionaries for that. On the other hand, I want it to be accessible to the modern reader, right? So that is one of my goals in translating, no matter what time period it's from. But even if we're talking about now, about the contemporary world, if you don't understand the culture that you're translating from, it will be very difficult for you to be successful, I think, in your translation. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the sexism and racism, I guess many times I'm making the choice of what text that I'm translating, not always when I'm hired to translate, when I'm paid to translate. I'm not always making the choice. So I haven't really come across a great deal of that. The one thing that I do work on are the pronouns. So I try to make the pronouns more inclusive whenever possible. And I have a real beef with the idea that the word hombres would actually be inclusive for men and women. And in fact, I mean, that's what, you know, very traditional linguists would say. But however, hombres, in my opinion, that expression could actually be inaccurate, right? So what does hombres mean? Are you talking about a group of men and women, or are you talking about a group of men? So for someone like me who's concerned about the accuracy of language, I want to be sure that it's not just a group of men, right? So that's why I prefer to use other terms that make it clear exactly what we're talking about, right? And then, of course, you know, it's also just simply that for many, many centuries, the use of the word hombre or man has stood in for all people, but it doesn't actually represent all people. So that is one thing that I do work really hard on in my translations, is just to be really inclusive and accurate with the pronouns.
Yes, I think of, you know, ellos could be one guy and 375 women, and it's going to be ellos.
Exactly.
Or chicos en vez de chicas. Sor Juana brings back some good memories, what an incredible figure. I was lucky enough to read some of her work in college. Even Sor, is that the same as monja, or is that like a main sister, like the main
nun? I mean, that is the title, right? I mean, we would usually use sister, right? But that when it's used as a title, they use the word Sor.
Todavía, even in 2021, that would still be the term?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Very interesting. I wonder about the different styles of Spanish, the different dialects of different countries. You know, do you feel like you work from a standardized Spanish, if that's even possible? Do you feel like people would be able to tell that your Spanish is very tinged with you know, Mexican Spanish? How does that work?
Well, I know that in the corporate world, they will strive for a neutral Spanish. I'm not sure that, I guess, or a universal Spanish, that would be something that the idea would be that it would be a Spanish that everyone would understand. But and perhaps that's possible in the corporate world, but in my experience as a translator, I think that really there's a Spanish that belongs to Spain and there's a Spanish that belongs to Mexico, for example. And those, although the Mexican Spanish is derived from Spain, they're very different languages. And so I like to really say that I translate from Mexican Spanish. That is sort of my specialty. I mean, I can translate from continental Spanish as well, and I have. For example, Mexican Spanish, it has a lot of words originating from Nahuatl, right? And so it's really quite distinct from continental Spanish, and it has wonderful and creative and fun slang, right? Lots of slang. Just in the same way that when I translate into English, I am translating into American English, right? I can translate for a British audience, and I have, but it's more natural for me to translate into American English. So I do really think that each country is quite distinct, and even each region. I mean, I definitely learned that living in Mexico, that there were words, especially slang, that was used in Oaxaca that wasn't used in Mexico City, or that was understood in a different way. And yes, people have told me when I speak Spanish that I speak it not only with a Mexican accent, but with a Oaxacan accent.
Ah, wow. Very, very specific. Wow. You have such a cool and eclectic series of interests in the punk rock and some of the genres that you study and have taught in. I wonder what are some especially fun genres or topics that you really like to translate in? Like about sports or about music or sci-fi, you know, that type of thing.
I really love literature, novels in particular. and poet and contemporary poetry. And I've also done a lot of translation of art criticism, which gets pretty creative. It's usually the art criticism that I have translated has been written by writers more so than, say, art historians. I mean, that's sort of a general, I think, tendency in Mexico. So they can be quite beautiful and creative in the way that they talk about art. And since I have an art background, that's a lot of the kind of translation that I've done in the past.
Like describing art or like art criticism?
Well, maybe a little of both, right? Okay. So we're talking about like coffee table art books and, you know, art catalogs where there's an essay included or multiple essays included.
You know, I was a basketball coach for many years. I love to play basketball. As a coach, I would watch differently. I would watch on TV. I would watch live differently because I'm a coach now, you know. Somebody would be celebrating because somebody did a slam dunk. I'd be thinking, you know, what made that person able to do, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Ever since TiVo and DVR came around, I'm always rewinding, watching things. Oh, I'd like to run that play. Same, I know, with writers where they're going to read differently. They're going to read almost as, you know, because it's part of their career. They're going to read others' work differently. Sorry for my long-winded example, but I wonder with you as a translator, do you read other people's translations differently? Do you have trouble enjoying it? Or is that a good thing? You know, but do you read them differently?
Yeah, I definitely read them differently. I'm looking at, okay, what is this person doing? How are they translating? Do I agree with it? Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, even though I might not have read the original, but there are times when I go, yeah, this is just not right. Okay. Right. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just three or four times in an entire book, right? But I remember one translator, professor of translation, she said, you know, there's usually, even the best translator, there's usually at least one time in the book where they don't get it right, you know? Mm. So, you know, I try not to be too harsh, although there are some, you know, occasionally there's a translation that I just don't like.
You did some work with closed captioning and subtitles, yeah?
Yeah, I did.
I think that's so interesting. First of all, I mean, I'm sure a lot of it is electronic now or automatic or whatever you want to say, but I'm amazed at how many subtitles there are for, you know, obscure movies, obscure TV shows, etc. I'm just amazed at how much content is out there. Do you ever watch TV with the subtitles just to see how they do with it?
Oh, sure. Yeah, definitely. I mean, so for a while I was actually having some trouble with my hearing. And so I was using the subtitles or the closed captioning in English for when I watch things. And now, you know, sometimes I turn it on. Well, I've been watching some TV programs in Catalan. So sometimes I'll turn that on, or even occasionally, you know, I'll watch something in Spanish and the slang is unfamiliar to me, so I'll occasionally turn it on too. So, I mean, subtitles are hard because you have a time limit and a space limit, but, you know, it really is an art. And so one really appreciates when you have a good subtitler.
I'm really interested in Catalan. I had a high school Spanish teacher who was from Barcelona, mm-hmm. and he... You know, with the immaturity of youth, when he showed us or told us what some Catalan, and we were like, what? You know, am I oversimplifying it to say that it's a mix of French and Spanish?
Well, a little, but I think that my French and Spanish definitely helps my understanding of Catalan, but but of course it's not as if you've studied both of those languages, it's not as if you'll instantly understand Catalan. I mean, I've taken one semester, now I'm halfway through the second semester. I'm finding that I can read quite a bit and understand maybe about 65% of what I'm reading without looking at the dictionary. But again, that's with a semester's worth of training, but I have a ways to go.
Could we do something simple like my name is, and this is how old I am? So if I were to say, yo soy Pedro y yo tengo 41 años, 41 años, Yo soy Pedro y yo tengo 41 años. How might you say that in Catalan?
Yo soy Pedro o el Pedro. Because they use the pronoun before the names, but only when you're referring to another person, not when you're referring to yourself. So
okay.
Yo soy Pedro y tengo 41 años.
Mm-hmm. Más o menos, ¿no? Bastante mm-hmm. similar, bastante semejante. Yeah. I love to look at one of the translations. We would look at, this is an excerpt, correct, from La Ciudad Lucía.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a poem by
Paola. Paola y la Vaca Núñez.
And who is she?
She is a poet from Chile.
Okay.
She's written quite a few books of poetry, and this particular book forms part of a trilogy of poetry
mm-hmm.
that more or less look at sort of different stages of a woman's life, including adolescence. And she's also a novelist. She's won some prizes. She teaches literature. Came across this sort of by accident. I think mm-hmm. I was just trying to find, I think I did a search for just, you know, women poets in Spanish or something like that. And okay. she popped up and we eventually started writing to each other. And nice. We seem to have a kind of, you know, friendly relationship now.
Nice. Se llama La Ciudad Lucía. Lucía in English is like what, to shine, to.
Well, it's really, yeah, it's like it's a play on words, right? Mm-hmm. So it's Lucía can be the name or it can also be to shine, right?
And it starts off and it says, Lucía dice, and I guess that's, is that kind of like an epigraph?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Each section has an epigraph.
Okay. And it's, he'll hang the hearts black and dull as the night. That's from Cherry Colored Funk by the Cocteau Twins.
Yes. And so, yeah, after the epigraph is this, I guess the second epigraph maybe, and it's always a quote from a song.
Okay.
Just from lyrics from a song, just a couple of lines.
So what do you think? Maybe I can read the, it's about, I don't know, 10 or 11 lines, and then maybe you can talk about the translation.
Well, how about if then I read the translation and then talk about it? Does that sound okay?
Sounds good.
Okay. You want to start?
I will start. Ella dijo mi violencia será este ciudad, este cuidado mal visto. Ella dijo mi vestido. Y sollozó lentejuelas pasmadas avenidas. Las gestas y las calles de la ciudad despejan un dibujo. Ella dijo dibujo. Mientras duerme, ella dijo, duerme. Y velaron demonios baja la cama. Esta ciudad no. Esta ciudad y su trono. Mi violencia es cemento. Ella dijo en su trono. Mi violencia es cemento. Y primo sobre todas las cosas. And my apologies if I, you know, messed up the line breaks.
Well, I just gave it to you before we started.
No problem. I thought I did pretty well. Tell us about the translation.
Okay, well, I'd like to read the translation first.
Please, so, please.
She said, my violence will be this unseemly care, she said. My dress and wept sequins, frozen avenues, the city's gestures and streets disclose a drawing. She said, drawing, while she dozed. She said, sleep, and devils watched from under her bed. This city, no, this city and its throne, my violence is cement, she said on her throne. My violence is cement, and she reigned over all things.
I misread that. That's primo.
Yeah.
Not primo, yeah. Primo.
It's okay. So I guess, you know, one thing that I really noticed about Paola y la Vaca's poetry, so there's a definite rhythm to it, and there's mm-hmm. sort of like unnatural stops to it as well in the language.
Okay.
There's repetition.
Yes.
There's these enjambments, you know, of the lines. So I really, and there's also, there's alliteration in it. So I worked hard to create that sense of sound and rhythm in the, that was a really important part to me in the translation, was the sound and the rhythm to capture those kind of awkward breaks and those kind of, there's also this, at a certain point, it sort of speeds up, right? And so I tried to capture that time, those times when it just, there's like a dead stop, and there are times when it just kind of catches up to itself, you know.
I don't know if enjoy is a word, but I definitely enjoy your translation. I'm wondering about, you know, so I mean, the first word of the poem is ella. I mean, it's ella, 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 I muchas ellas. My understanding, maybe I'm wrong, is for gestures is los gestos, pero ella dice, ella escribe las gestas.
Yeah, as far as I know, that has a similar meaning. Okay. Yes.
So, you know, using the feminine there. And then you, we have duerme at least twice, and you have it as dozing, I believe.
Yeah, that's because I was also trying to capture some of that repetition of sound, right? Mm. So in the original, it's de la ciudad despejan un dibujo. Ella dijo dibujo mientras duerme. Ella dijo duerme. Y velaron demonios. So there's this constant repetition of D, 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 D. So I tried to get some of that in the English. Obviously, you know, I can't do it exactly.
That is so cool. That is so cool to talk to the translator herself about those decisions. Like you said a few times, there are so many decisions, so many choices, and that makes a lot of sense. Wow, very interesting. Right. Thank you for sharing that little excerpt. That is very interesting to see the breakdown. As you get very intimate with the writing, so much so that you talk about the alliteration, changing things around in that way. I wonder what some of your future projects are.
Well, I'm working on this sample translation. I'm working on a translation of Sor Juana's last book, The Enigmas.
Okay.
That's been quite a challenge, a bigger challenge than I had imagined. But you know, I had to pick Sor Juana of all the poets I could have picked, right? And I have a short story by Elena Poniatowska about the earthquake in the Mexico City earthquake in 1985 that I've been working on for a while, and it really only needs the finishing touches, but I never get to it. Same with a poem by Javier Cecilia. And whatever I can, you know, whatever calls my fancy.
Well, I appreciate the little kick there to remind me. I know I've heard great things about Lewis Selly, who you mentioned earlier. The woman you just mentioned.
Great writer.
Right? Elena.
Kowalska. There are many, and there are many up and coming women Mexican writers. Mm-hmm. I mean, some very established. Right. I encourage people to read widely, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I definitely know Javier Cecilia to be like an activist, no?
Yes, that was what happened after his son was unfortunately killed. He became an activist out of you know, a compulsion for what had happened in his own life. Yeah.
Right. Kind of apropos of not apropos of nothing, apropos of not as much, but I'm reminded as we talk about translation, Juan Rulfo, because I have trouble saying his last name, one of the great Mexican writers. One of the stories that I've taught in English, even in my English classes, is I never felt like it was a good translation. It's called No Oyes Ladrar Los Perros in Español.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a huge change in the story where this father is speaking to his son, and it goes from the tú form to usted.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember just being like, wow, that couldn't exist in English.
No, not really. I mean, it could exist in Old English, right? In because we had thee and thou before. Okay. But I think the translator would attempt something that would be maybe a register of more formal speech, but impossible to do it in exactly the same in contemporary English.
Yeah, I mean, those are the thrilling things about reading. You know, I was just like, oh my gosh, because there's so much to that. There's the kind of pushing away, like, you're not part of me, you're not, you know, we're not as close, we're not as much intimacy with one word, you know, with to usted. Like you said, I'm sure that translators would do things and make it more formal, but it's not as immediate as it would be there.
Yeah, and also the use of usted and tu is really complicated. I mean, when they teach you in Spanish class, they tell you, you know, this is for formal situations, it's for older people. But in its actual use, I have found, even, for example, that in Mexico City, they use tu more than they do in Oaxaca, okay. Right? Also, occasionally, an older adult will use the usted form with a child in sort of a particular way of kind of addressing them. I think it's both affectionate and also a way of respect and almost a sense of, you know, this is what you will be when you grow up.
Oh, wow.
You will be addressed as usted, right?
Wow, how cool is that? What a pleasure. I've had a chance to talk to writers of all different types and stripes, and to have a translator and editor. So cool. I believe you're definitely the first been able to speak with who's a translator. And I really appreciate you talking about those choices and all the interesting things that go into it. And with your Sor Juana piece, I say piece, it's a huge project and all of the other things. I wish you a great luck, and thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. And I'm glad that you recognize that translation forms a very important part of literature, and it always has throughout history.
No doubt about it. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for listening to episode 46 with Rowena Galovitz. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave me a 5-star review. You can also ask for the podcast by name using Alexa and find it on Stitcher, that's new, Spotify, and on Amazon Music. Follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast, or on Twitter, where I'm at Chills at Will PO1. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look in an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills at Will Podcast is Wind Down, instrumental version, and the other song played on this episode was Hoops, instrumental by Matt Whitehour. And both great songs are used through archesaudio.com. For now, thanks again for listening. And I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers and creatives with mad skills, like Rowena Galovitz, whose work gives you chills at will. Thank you.